I'm Reverend Lisa Day, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Welcome to our weekly radio program, where you'll hear a segment from one of our recent services recorded at our church on beautiful Troop Square. We invite you to join us Sundays at 11 a.m. in person or via live stream on Zoom. You can find the Zoom link and more about Unitarian Universalism in Savannah at our website, uusavannah.org. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. My name is Jane Rago, and I'll be serving as your worship associate today. Our minister, the Reverend Lisa Day, is our worship leader this morning. Here at the UU Church of Savannah, we are working to build a diverse, multicultural, and beloved community. We celebrate the presence and participation of people of all races, genders, sexual orientations, abilities, and ethnic and national origins. We warmly welcome you here on site and on YouTube, whoever you know yourself to be and wherever you are on your journey. With the lighting of our chalice, symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith, we enter into sacred time. Our chalice lighting words come from Bear Kuluzka. As we light the chalice, may our souls become its hearth. We join our hearts to the one great flame of bright compassion, beloved community, and fervent justice. May we become lanterns to the world, lighting the way for all.
Each time we gather for worship, a new body is created. Never before has quite this same congregation come together, and never again. The weekly recreation of this faith community brings the possibility of new consciousness. Together, may we see the familiar with new eyes, hear the familiar with new ears, sing and say the familiar with new voices. Come, let us worship together. The words of meditation this morning from Unitarian Universalist Minister Lynn Unger, October 7th. Today, I discovered a tiny handful of raspberries ripening on a vine that finished bearing fruit back in July. Make of it what you will, but perhaps you could also use the reminder that what is going on is not the same as where you put your attention. That what you know will happen is not the same as what is possible. That the world has always found unaccountable ways to ripen and grow sweet. Our first reading this morning, Compassion Needs Weather, is also by Unitarian Universalist Minister, the Reverend Dr. David Breeden. Compassion is not a hothouse flower. Compassion needs weather. The frost of failure, the storm of anger, the flood of regret, the drought that says there's nothing left to say. Compassion loves rough soil, the stones, weeds, the cracks between our best intentions. Compassion does not bloom quickly. It leans toward light, but does not fear shadow. Compassion is not a hothouse flower. It is a tough, persistent wildflower growing between the cracks of the hottest, hardest days. Compassion loves the rough soil of humanity. And from Lowell Yeager, After Second Shift. She stopped to shop for groceries. her snow boots sloshing up and down the aisles, the store deserted, couple stock boys droning through cases of canned goods, one sleepy checker at the till. In the parking lot, an elderly man stands mumbling outside his sedan, all four doors wide to gusting sleet and ice. She asks him, "Are you okay?" He's wearing pajama pants, torn slippers, rumpled sport coat, knit wool hat. He says he's waiting for his wife. "I just talked to her on the payphone over there." He's pointing at the Coke machine. "What payphone?" she says. "That one," he says. "It's cold," she says, and escorts him inside. "Don't come with lights and sirens," she tells the 911 dispatcher. "You'll scare him." They stand together. The checker brings him a cup of coffee. They talk about the snow, so much snow. They watch for the cop. This night, black as any night, or a bit less so. Here end the readings. About 30 years ago, Charles Figley, the Paul Henry Kurzweig Chair in Disaster Mental Health at Tulane University, coined the phrase compassion fatigue to refer to absorbing information and often the suffering of others through empathy. It happens when a helping professional experiences exhaustion due to caring for someone and can lead to professional, emotional, and physical erosion that takes place when helpers are unable to refuel and regenerate themselves. More recently, the phrase has come into common usage to signify the experience of being overwhelmed when we encounter heart-wrenching story after heart-wrenching story of loss, death, cruelty, illness, natural disaster. Particularly, but not exclusively, when such stories are accompanied by an ask. Our hearts can only bear so much suffering, it seems, even suffering far removed from our daily lives. We can only care so much before we ourselves begin to suffer sleeplessness, depression, or self-medication. Or alternately, before we begin to become inured, to turn away and to tune out gestures of self-preservation. Tune out as gestures of self-preservation. This morning's sermon title, Compassion Says, comes from Rabbi Esther Adler, who said, "There's a hierarchy of responses when we encounter suffering. Pity says, 'I see your pain.' Sympathy says, 'I understand your pain.' Empathy says, 'I feel your pain.' Compassion says, 'I am with you in your pain and I will help.'" I think we all want to be compassionate, to answer the call of someone else's pain with whatever help we can give. Still, compassion fatigue is real, and I know I'm not alone in often feeling stretched beyond my capacity to witness, feel, and respond to the pain of others in any meaningful way. The world holds too much suffering, too much for our hearts to hold without breaking, and too much for our minds to make sense of. Such as these days, the compassion that threatens to fatigue us, to mire us in paralyzing despair, that compassion is often all mixed up with fear and outrage and moral indignation. I don't need to tell you what it feels like or how it affects our spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical health, or how it impacts our ability to carry out our daily lives. I can tell you what I think is a piece of good news. The antidote to fear, outrage, and moral indignation is the same as the antidote to the threat of compassion fatigue. It's a two-step process available to us all and within our capacity to access. The first, more challenging step is to allow ourselves to feel the feeling. Feel compassion, feel outrage, fear, moral indignation. Resist the impulse to deny, bury, or distract ourselves away from them. We already know that doesn't work. We might stop watching, listening to, or reading the news. We might delete all our social media apps, but somehow the state of the world seeps through. Word that another friend has lost their job at the CDC, another family member's military career destroyed by an unjust policy, another day of starvation in Gaza, another U.S. city invaded by forces sent unlawfully by the current administration, another acquaintance whose immunocompromised health is further threatened by changes in vaccine policy. These stories seep into conversations with friends and colleagues, are woven into family text threads, season late-night talk show monologues. Turning our back to the sources of fear, outrage, moral indignation, turning our back to the situations that call forth our compassion doesn't protect us. And self-medication, in whatever form it takes, alcohol, drugs, food, shopping, gaming, only make us sick or sends us into debt or estranges us from people and activities that might feed our spirits. Occasional momentary distractions, walks on beach, funny movies, cell phone-free meals with beloved companions, these are important acts of self-care to the extent that they refresh us and strengthen us to then turn back to witness suffering and the sources of our fear, outrage, and moral indignation with wide, curious, and courageous eyes and with robust and resilient wills. After that, after turning back to witness, the second easy step is to take action to help the person or the group for whom we're feeling compassion. Take action towards stopping, reversing, or repairing the situation that sparks our fear or outrage. That might sound like the more difficult, even insurmountable task. But big, heroic gestures are not necessary. Doing it all immediately, once and for all time, is neither necessary nor even possible, of course. Small, meaningful actions help the person for whom we feel compassion and begin to resolve that situation that scares or outrages us and helps us too. Small, meaningful actions are the antidote to compassion fatigue, the inoculation against despair born of all that threatens to overwhelm us. A colleague texted me 2 minutes before we were scheduled to have a phone meeting earlier this week. They had requested the meeting to seek my counsel on a tricky issue in their congregation, but they needed to postpone it to some later date due to a family crisis that had layered itself upon the tricky situation. They were profusely apologetic about having requested my time and then canceling at the last moment. My response, no apology necessary. You're going to be where you need to be. Those words sounded familiar and nagged at me for hours, and then I remembered. Just weeks into my first year of divinity school, I was scheduled to attend a fall UU district gathering in a nearby town. A minister I had never yet met had agreed to pick me up on campus and give me a ride. Then my grandfather died and I got strep throat. In my double misery, as I was trying to decide whether or not to fly to Minnesota for the funeral, worried about the consequences of missing days of classes so early in the semester, but wanting to be at home with my family, I called the minister to tell her I wouldn't be going to the meeting and to apologize for causing her to rearrange her schedule to accommodate giving me a ride and then canceling at the last minute. Her reply, "No apology necessary. You will be where you need to be." This week, I couldn't do anything to help resolve my colleagues' professional or family situations, or even alleviate the fear and anxiety they were feeling in response to the family emergency. But I could help with the guilt they were feeling about canceling our appointment. You're going to be where you need to be. I was with them in their suffering, and I took action to help, letting them let themselves off the hook. My future colleague all those years ago couldn't do anything to allay my anxiety about missing classes or soothe my grief or reduce my fever, but she could and did help with the guilt I felt about inconveniencing her and missing the gathering, which seemed so unprofessional to me. You'll be where you need to be. She was with me in my suffering, and she took action to help, letting me let myself off the hook. In our story this morning, the parents couldn't do anything significant or grand to eliminate the sources of their daughter's fear and anxiety, the frightening realities she learned about from the news. But they were with her in her suffering, and they took immediate, small but not insignificant actions to help her. "Come with me," they each said in their turn, and walked hand in hand through streets and into subways that we're told are dangerous places. Walked hand in hand into grocery stores and bakeries owned and staffed by people whose cultures we are told to fear and distrust. You have to see the pictures to understand that. Teaching her step by step to be brave and trusting. Teaching her to say, "Come with me." And trusting her to be brave without them by their side. By her side. Now, when this book came up in my catalog search for picture books about compassion, I was doubtful. I mean, I like it because it's not a didactic examination of compassion wrapped in a thin veneer of story. But is it about compassion? Shouldn't it be more, I don't know, touchy-feely? Then I saw Buddhist nun Jen Kalsang Demo interviewed on the Modern Buddhism podcast. From her, I learned that looking at suffering leads to depression or the experience of being overwhelmed only if we stop there. Stop at the looking. If we move on to the next step of taking action to alleviate suffering, if we focus on solutions, we free ourselves as well as the suffering one. One of her examples was surprising and powerful. She told a story about the mother of a young adult who had been paralyzed from the neck down. She remarked on the intense level of 24-hour care people who are quadriplegic require. And she said that out of compassion for her son, that mother took immaculate care of herself. She ate regular, nutritious meals, stayed hydrated, exercised, spent time with friends in enjoyable pursuits, got enough sleep, laughed frequently. She was with her son in his suffering, and despite what was probably her deepest desire, she could do nothing to restore his body. Instead, the best, most meaningful way she had to alleviate his suffering was to stay strong and healthy in order to tend to his physical needs, vibrant and grounded in order to companion him to the end of his days, tending to his emotional, social, and spiritual needs. So too with the parents in the picture book. Offstage, so to speak, maybe they were organizing and rallying and calling elected officials and donating money to do their part in stopping or undoing the things that were frightening their daughter when she heard about them on the news. And maybe along with the organizing, rallying, calling, and donating of lots of other people, eventually the news would be less frightening. But their daughter was suffering now, and they were with her in her suffering, so they took her by the hand, saying, "Come with me," and walked into their fears together. And so their suffering, and all of their suffering, the daughter's, papa's, mama's suffering, abated just a tiny bit. None of this is to say we can't or shouldn't do the big public things, the organizing, rallying, phone banking, and letter writing, protecting our migrant neighbors, and all the rest. That kind of action in response to the suffering we see almost everywhere, the systems and conditions and actions that spark our fear and outrage and moral indignation, that kind of action will also help us stave off depression and despair. And someday, eventually, all of us together taking those actions and so many, many more will stop the harm and turn the tide toward repairing our communities and rebuilding our democracy and reinventing our systems. In the meantime, perhaps "come with me" is the invitation compassion extends when it says, "I am with you in your pain and I will help." Come with me. Together we will help one another, because when your pain is relieved through whatever small gift I can offer, my pain is relieved by your allowing me to offer the gift. Come with me into the pain, and together we'll emerge from it, hand in hand, step by step, into a world transformed by our compassion. May it be so. Amen.
This is Reverend Lisa Day. I hope you've enjoyed this program from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Please join us at one of our services sometime soon at our church on Troop Square or live on Zoom. We're the beacon of liberal religion in Savannah, and you can find out more at uusavannah.org. We meet on Sundays at 11 a.m. Thanks for listening.